Morning, everyone. To greet you in Jesus' name this morning. It's good to be with you. May God bless each of you as you find the place He has for you and as you serve Him in the challenges you are facing each of your lives. Also, thank you, Brother Dave, for sharing that report on our conference. Still a new thing for me, but I enjoyed being there, and it was a blessing to be there, and enjoyed he said in that report that he felt empty, and they were missing a bunch of people. To me, it felt big. There were a lot of people there, and I didn't know all of them, but enjoyed my time there, enjoyed listening to the broader discussion and the broader input of various brethren. For a sermon this morning, I entitled my subject, Christian Discipleship. Something we hear about a lot, perhaps. It relates to a lot of different aspects in our life, but it was good for me to think about this and think how it applies to our life. What is a disciple? A Christian disciple is obviously one who is following Christ. What is a disciple? Well, it's a learner, someone who is learning. So someone who is learning to be like Christ in this situation. It's someone who is following one's teaching. So that's pretty simple. We pick up the Bible and we read it, and we have Jesus' teaching and we follow it. One of the definitions of a disciple that Jesus gave is in John 8:31. Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, "If ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." If you continue in my word, you are my disciples. A disciple is one who voluntarily adheres to the teachings of another. Maybe I could say this, it's not a lecturing session where you're in a class because your parents put you there, or because you need to be there because your boss sent you, or something like that. It's not just a lecturing session, but rather you're adhering to the teachings of another because you want to. You want to follow him. It's your heart's desire. A disciple is also an imitator, or copying someone you admire. It's always fun watching in little children when they're trying to imitate somebody, and they watch and try to exactly follow what the person they're admiring is doing. Even big people do that. Like it or not, you probably imitate somebody. Maybe you try to hide it, maybe you try to deny it, but you probably try to imitate somebody. Most importantly, we want to imitate our Master Jesus Christ. Being a disciple of Jesus is believing and confessing by your life and speech. We heard about that some in Sunday school. You believe in Jesus and you confess it both by the way you live and by the way you talk. So in a sense, it's very simple to be a disciple of Jesus. Perhaps sometimes we make it too simple. We obey Jesus, we follow his word, it equals being a disciple. Another place he says, love one another. So we love one another, it equals being his disciple. And we find it pretty easy to look at that and say, yeah, that's right. We check the box, we close the book, and we move on in life. But maybe it's more complex than that. Maybe it's more challenging than that. How well do I imitate Jesus in everyday life? How well do I follow Jesus as I go about my work, as I relate to my family, as I relate to my church? How well am I imitating the example he left me? You know, we don't just do things, or we shouldn't just do things because we're a Christian and that's the way a Christian does them. We know we do this because we have to do it. Whatever it is, you fill in the blank. But we do things the way we do them because we want to be like Jesus. We want to be like our Master.
We want to imitate him in every way possible. And sometimes that may mean we need to forego an earthly pleasure or some kind of enjoyment for our own spiritual good. Perhaps it means we give time, we give money, we give resources again and again and again, maybe even to the same person again and again. But it's why we voluntarily chose to become a Christian. It's because we want the peace, the joy, and the fulfillment that we find in serving the Lord instead of the bondage of serving ourselves. So I have 6 points this morning. I think it's six of them. That I wrote down as a way to instruct us in ways that we can, things we can do to be a better disciple of Jesus Christ. And my desire is that as we go over these, you can each apply them to your personal life, to the day-to-day experiences that you're facing, and be inspired and challenged by them to walk more like your Lord. You may turn to Matthew chapter 19. A lot of these come from Matthew and from other Gospels. Matthew chapter 19, we have the story of the rich young ruler that came to Jesus. And we're familiar with that story. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I'd like to just narrow in on verse 21 and verse 22. Jesus said unto him, "If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me." But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. I titled point number one, Pursuing Perfect Discipleship. You know, the young man came to Jesus and asked him what he has to do to be perfect. And Jesus said, if you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and come follow me. This individual said he had obeyed everything. He had done everything, but he was missing something. And while obedience is extremely important, and in no way I want to minimize that this morning, obedience is a very necessary part of following Jesus, but it takes more than obedience. Here he had obeyed the whole law, but he still knew he was missing something. It's more than obedience. It's giving up all for Jesus. Giving up what's important to me. This rich man was not willing to do that. He says he had great possession and he was not willing to give them up. He turned away from Jesus and he went the other direction. It's the last we hear about him as far as we know in Scripture. Did he ever come back? I hope so, but we don't know. But we give up what's important to us. One reason we give it up is so we can help others. Jesus said that he should he should give to the poor. Sell what he has and gives to the poor. So we give up to give to others. And another reason I see here that we give up is so that we can follow Jesus unhindered. This man's riches were a hindrance to him following Jesus. And I challenge you to make that personal to your life. You know, it's more than earthly riches we have to give up. Perhaps even though we're in that top 1% we heard about in devotions this morning, sometimes we feel like we don't have anything to give. But there's many other things we need to give beyond just our wealth or our possessions. That's part of it. But it's anything that can hinder our following Jesus. Anything that would come between us and Jesus, and we'll look at some more of those in the following points. The other thing I'd like to notice here is that when the disciples, they said there in verse 25, who then can be saved? This looked very difficult to them, but Jesus said, with men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. And God can help us in that to give up what would hinder so that we can pursue perfect discipleship. Pursuing perfect discipleship sometimes takes us outside of what we consider the normal parameters or comforts of life. people were seeking to follow Jesus. If we go to Matthew chapter 8, we won't go there, but in verse 20, Jesus said, "The foxes have holes and the birds of air have their nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head." There were people there who were wanting to follow Jesus, but had other things they wanted to do first, had their own things they wanted to do. And Jesus had very little time for them. Jesus' simple command was, "Follow me." And that is still his call to us. Point number two, I go to the Gospel of John for this one. John chapter 21, you can turn there if you care to. I'm going to read a few verses. John chapter 21, verse 21. This comes right after Jesus had challenged Peter on his love to him. He had asked him three times, "Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me?" And then he gave him some instruction. And verse 20, we just start reading there. "Then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? And Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me." I don't have a real defined title for this point, but I guess I would call it comparing ourselves with others. What will this man do? Jesus said, "Follow thou me." Don't be concerned about him. Peter's commitment of love to Jesus that he had made a couple of verses previous here had to also include a commitment of following Jesus. And our commitment, the standard of our commitment, the level of commitment that we're committing ourselves to needs to be patterned after Jesus Christ. He comes to each of us and says, "Follow me." And while I believe our peers have a very important part in influencing our life, and as long as they're the right kind of peers, they call us to a higher level of commitment. They can be a right influence for us, and they're an important part of that influence. But Jesus still says, "Follow me," and primarily our commitment needs to be to him and to the standard that he sets for us. We don't set our standard by our peers or those of perceived of less, those whom we perceive to be of lesser religious intelligence or practice. You think about the Pharisee and the publican, in the Pharisee's prayer where he said, "I'm not like this man, I'm better, I'm doing well." That's not how we evaluate ourselves. Nor do we evaluate ourselves by some self-created estimation of who God is and what he requires of us. Rather, we take him and his word and apply it to ourselves. And "Follow thou me" becomes a personal experience for each of us. And while it is a very personal thing, we will also note here that Peter was with others. There were others around him. And I believe fellowship with others is also, while our commitment to Jesus is a very personal thing, we also associate with others in that commitment. Those who draw us to a higher standard of fellowship with God. We do not do well to compare ourselves among ourselves. Rather, we seek to follow Jesus because of who he is and because of our desire to follow him. Number three, being a disciple of Jesus is identifying with him as a servant. We create an identity with Jesus by following him as a servant. I believe serving and following are something that go very hand in hand. A willingness to confess our belief in Him and following Him is proven by our service to Him. That is finally how we prove our willingness to confess and our following Him is how we serve Him. And sometimes here on this earth we like to associate with people because of who they are, and we think maybe it makes us a little more important. We like to be seen with somebody because of who they are. It's an ego booster for us. That's not why we associate with Jesus. It's not because we want to look like somebody important. A couple of verses from John chapter 12, verse 24. John chapter 12, verse 24 says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honor." I like how it says there in verse 26, "If any man serve him, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be." Where Jesus goes, his servant's going to be with him because he's following Jesus and he's trying to imitate Jesus. And it's okay to be a servant because we're trying to serve Jesus, even to the point of having to lose our own life. That's how intent we need to be on serving Jesus, that our own life becomes of no value. The other thing that I think ties right in here with this is the thought of humility, servanthood, humility. We could go back to Matthew chapter 18. Maybe I'll take the time to read those verses there. Matthew chapter 18, the disciples were trying to figure out who was the greatest, who was going to hold the highest place in Jesus' kingdom. Verse 2, "Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them and said, Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive such one such little child in my name receiveth me. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea." Humility is part of servanthood. Part of serving Jesus is not trying to see who is the greatest, not trying to aspire to some kind of position, but rather being like that little child that Jesus used as an illustration. Our goal is to be converted and to become like little children so we can join Jesus in the kingdom of heaven. We identify with Jesus by following him as a servant. Number 4, I call this one the attitude of the Beatitudes. Matthew chapter 5. We have what we call the Beatitudes here in the first 12 verses. I'll maybe just skip down through these verses and read the first phrase out of each one, beginning at verse 3. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Verse 4, "Blessed are they that mourn." "Blessed are the meek." "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness." "Blessed are the merciful." "Blessed are the pure in heart." "Blessed are the peacemakers." "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake." Verse 11, "Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." the attitude that Jesus was promoting here. You know, there's nothing in these verses that is instructing you how to be some kind of self-made man or some kind of self-exaltation. It's an attitude, again, of servanthood and humility. I summarized it into 4 points. And this thing of having the attitude of the Beatitudes. A disciple of Jesus is, first of all, willing to suffer for his master. Secondly, he has a meek and quiet spirit that is sensitive to the needs of others. Thirdly, he pursues righteous living and purity in all areas of life. And fourthly, he has a peaceful disposition. He's willing to suffer for his master. He has a meek and quiet spirit that is sensitive to the needs of others. He pursues righteous living and purity in all areas of life. And he has a peaceful disposition. And that's quite the, as we think about, the way we relate to life and the responsibilities and the contacts we have in life with various people. It's a high calling, but it's one of the ways that we can follow our master, that we can imitate him. Number 5, ways we imitate Christ, ways we follow him. We need to do that. We need to forsake all. And I had to think of Peter. He was mentioned there in our Sunday school lesson again today. If we go to Matthew chapter 16, verse 21, Jesus is telling his disciples that he's going to need to suffer. Verse 22, Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, "Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee." But he turned and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." Then said Jesus unto his disciples, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, and take up his cross, and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" I think we have two opposing opinions here. One is the things of the world, and the other is the things of God. And Peter still had, it seems like he had his mindset was still of Jesus perhaps being an earthly king, Jesus being a victorious king. He did not comprehend this thing of Jesus suffering and dying. He says, "Lord, be it far from thee." But Jesus tried to help him understand that, no, we need to face this from the aspect of the things of God. Things that be of God instead of those that be of men. When we deny ourselves, take up his cross, and follow Jesus, we savor the things of God. We savor God's way of doing things. We want God's way of doing things. No, we don't always understand, but we follow because it's God's way. The other thing under forsaking, so we forsake our own agenda, we could say, our own plans, our own way of doing things, or the way we think they should be done. The other place that Jesus talks about this that comes to mind is in Luke chapter 14. He talks about forsaking all. He says in verse 26 of Luke 14, "If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Maybe we should just continue reading there. "For which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it? Lest haply, after he have laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first, and consulteth whether he is able, whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple.
I'm sure some of you can tell us much better why Jesus tied all those verses about counting the cost right into this subject, but he's talking here about things that would hinder us from following him. And while we know and believe that faithfulness and family responsibilities is a very important part of Christian discipleship, because the Bible tells us so, other places it uses strong language against those who are not faithful in their responsibilities. So while that is a very important part, it's not something that becomes between us and Jesus. Rather, it's something we do as part of our service to him. Following Jesus requires serious consideration. I believe that's one of the things he was saying here in looking at these different examples. These people had to give serious consideration to what they were doing so that they would be able to see it through. Jesus is not satisfied with half-hearted discipleship. He is only satisfied with a wholehearted commitment. We don't go into our Christian life and then, maybe I should say it this way, we go into our Christian life with the commitment that it goes ahead of all else. And we don't allow family and friendships and things like that to distract us from our service to God. We don't allow family life to make an excuse for anything less than a full commitment. And neither do we allow those that are close to us to distort our opinion of what God is calling us to. We follow truth. We follow God. We forsake anything that would come between us and our service to Jesus. Point number 6. I already referenced this earlier, but John chapter 13. Disciples of Jesus love one another. John chapter 13, verse 34. Jesus says, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love for one another." I'm sorry, if ye have love one to another. Jesus is calling his disciples to respond in love, where the carnal man would respond in hate and anger. And we know the power that that has. We see it happen yet today. As people who are wronged respond in love, it has a tremendous impact on those that they're responding to. It's one of the hallmarks of Jesus' disciples. It's something that identifies him, because he responds in love where normally he would respond in hate and anger. The question that came to me is, how would I fare if God would treat me with the same level of love that I treat those around me? If God would treat me with the same degree of love that I treat those around me, how would I make out? Do I have love? Do I have affection and benevolence for those I relate to? It was interesting looking at this word, love, and seeing some of the definitions that were connected with it. Affection and benevolence were some of them. Also, there were thoughts that, some of the thoughts that were connected with this thought of loving is that love is seen by the actions it prompts. Just like God proved his love by sending Jesus, we can see he sent Jesus and we can see his love through that. So our love is seen by the actions that it prompts,
not necessarily by the words that are spoken. Also, it's not a love that is drawn out by any excellency in its object. Well, there again, we can connect with God looking upon us as sinners and desiring to save us. There was nothing in us that drew that love. Love is not drawn. It's not talking about a love that is drawn out by any excellency in its object. Rather, we love because it's what Jesus wants us to do. Another place, or several places in the Gospels, Jesus referred to the term that, maybe I should just turn there so I get it correct. One of the places was in Matthew chapter 9. He was quoting Old Testament scripture when he said, verse 13, he says, "Go ye and learn what that meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice." I believe this fits in thinking about this thought of loving one another as part of our being disciples of Jesus. Sacrifice is good. God put a whole sacrifice program into place in the Old Testament. But yet he said, "I want mercy instead of sacrifice." I don't think he was downplaying the effectiveness or the importance of sacrifice, but sacrifice without mercy is of no value. God is more pleased with benevolence and kindness than with mere external compliance to the duties of religion. God wants mercy along with our sacrifice. Our love must first of all be to God, expressing itself by obedience to his commandments. So first of all, we love God, and we express that by obeying him. And then is when we can do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. Our love then flows out to all men, especially to our brethren and sisters, but to all men. For closing verses, I'd like to leave you with a promise for the disciples of Jesus Christ. John chapter 25. We're very familiar with this account. I'm just going to read some of the verses. And obviously I made a mistake there, because John doesn't go to chapter 25. Where Jesus is talking about the dividing the sheep and the goats. It's Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25. He gives the parable of the stewards, the beginning of the chapter. When those stewards came to give account, he saith, their Lord came back in verse 19 and called them to give account, and he reckoned with them. Verse 20, and so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, "Lord, thou deliveredst unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more." His Lord said unto him, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." Then at the end of the chapter, verse 31, "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from the other, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. And shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. He goes on then to give the opposite for those who have not done it. But here were people who, I believe, understood what it meant to be disciples of Jesus. They followed him, they served him, and it affected their everyday actions, their walk of life. They gave service to the least of these, and it was rewarded with an invitation into the prepared kingdom of God. In John chapter 14, Jesus says, In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And as disciples of Jesus, you know, where else would we rather end up at? As we follow Jesus, as we try to imitate Jesus, where else would we have that lead us to than into those mansions with him for eternity? Communion for prayer.